Welcome in to the newest edition of the Just In Time Sports Podcast. I am your host, Justin Jackson. In this week's episode, we'll be talking about the NBA and what's going down there. We are barreling towards the start of the playoffs and the play-in. We'll be discussing college basketball as it wraps up its season, and we will have Jack's hot take. Now, as always, don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to the Just In Time Sports Podcast on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, don't forget to sit back and get ready to learn something.
JTS. Yeah. Just In Time Sports.
Life is good. Life is good.
Look. This is Just In Time Sports. Come and get your weekly takes. His opinion from the heart. He can never show you fake. If you winning or you losing, he gon' tell it to you straight. How we talking basketball without a Jordan Brown debate? If you got the hottest takes, you better come and make your case. If you win a couple games, he might even show you grace. JTS on every platform. We growing adaptation. Numbers going off the charts. We create the separation. Louisiana till I die. It's where I'm from. I can't replace it. So people minds are obtuse, but I like to be adjacent. Giving my opinion like I'm Nick Wright or I'm Jason. ESPN better watch out cause I'm coming for the spaceship. We even tweeting on Twitter, you can meet us in the spaces. Highlight clips of sports news, yeah, you gotta embrace it. We never had it easy, we just came from the pavement. I might be controversial, but I like to make my statements. This is Just In Time Sports, come and get your weekly takes. His opinion from the heart, he can never show you fake.
He can never show you fake.
Look, if you winning or you losing, he gon' tell it to you straight.
He gon' tell it to you, he gon' tell it to you, he gon' tell it.
This is Just In Time Sports, come and get your weekly takes.
Come and get it.
He gon' tell it to you straight, to you straight.
Welcome into the show, season 5, episode 5 of the Just In Time Sports Podcast. Welcome into the show. I'm excited to be with you as we are actually recording late-ish on a Thursday night. Typically, I don't record on Thursday nights. I play basketball, so I pick up basketball. Usually it just doesn't happen for me on a Thursday night. However, a special occasion, special times call for special occasions. And so recording this late on a Thursday night, actually watching my Pelicans play the Kings right now. So we do a standings update. As always, how we start in the NBA. It'll be entering tonight, being Thursday night's games, not counting the results of Thursday night. Because, for instance, the Knicks already played the Celtics. So these results are as entering Thursday night. But out east, let's jump right into it in the NBA. Out east, you have the Celtics as the runaway one seed. At this point, it's a formality that they're the runaway one seed. The Bucks minus 13.5 games back. So with that gap being so massive, and like we've done the past couple of weeks, we're going to discuss the East in relation to the Bucks. Considering the Bucks are the 2 seed, and kind of it doesn't make sense. The numbers get so laughable as far as the gap between whatever team and the Celtics. So, for instance, the Bucks are 13.5 back from the Celtics, and now we're going to go again in relation to the Bucks. So the Knicks are 1.5 games back from the Bucks. The Cavs are 2 games back. The Magic are 3 games back. The Pacers are also 3 games back. And that would be the rest of the playoffs. The play-in begins with the Sixers at 4 back. The Heat at 5 back. The Bulls at 11.5 back. And the Hawks at 13 back. However, out west, we don't have that issue. And I say we because I'm thinking about the totality of the NBA fandom in general. The gap between the Nuggets and the Warriors is the Nuggets at first and the Warriors at 10th is still less than the gap between the Celtics and the Bucks, and the Celtics and the Bucks are first and second in the East. Celtics, I said every team but them. The Celtics are looking to go 64-65 wins, while the rest of the East is struggling to get to 50. So that's usually the gap in terms of talent. The Bucks are looking, Celtics rather, are looking for one of the all-time seasons, regular season in Celtics history. So that is what they have on the line and what they are battling for the rest of this regular season. But anyway, out west, we have the Nuggets. That's currently the one seed. Again, entering Thursday's games, the Nuggets were the one seed. The Timberwolves are a game back. The Thunder are also a game back. So those three are battling for the number one seed. Then there's this gap. Okay? So the gap is it's a four-game gap. So that means the three teams I named, the Nuggets, the Timberwolves, and the Thunder, they're locked into the top three seeds. They're just battling over what order of the top three seeds they're going to have. But they're going to be top three. Then you have the Clippers as your four seed. They are currently five games back. The Mavs are six games back. The Pelicans round out the play-in, entering Thursday, round out the playoffs, entering Thursday's game at 8.5 games back. Okay? The Phoenix Suns are nine games back as the seventh seed. Then the Kings are 10.5 games back. The Lakers, locked into the play-in, are 11 games back. The Warriors, also locked into the play-in, are 11.5 games back, entering Thursday's night's competition. So just looking at the standings, some things that stand out to me. For instance, the Warriors and the Lakers, the Warriors and the Lakers are locked into the play-in. Mathematically, the Kings have an opportunity to get into the playoffs, but they would need the Pelicans and the Suns to pretty much lose out while they went out in order to get into the playoffs to have them go through the play-in. Now, the Pelicans and the Kings are currently playing. As it sits right now, it's 54-48 with about 3:34 left in the second quarter, Pelicans ahead. So there'd be a situation where the Kings can almost double jeopardy the Pelicans by gaining a win and putting a loss on their record. They're going to automatically gain a game, and I believe they would own the tiebreaker at that point, which would be huge because, of course, tiebreaker, they end up with the same record, the Kings would get in. So this is a big game for New Orleans and Sacramento. New Orleans playing without Brandon Ingram already. He's scheduled to return against the Lakers in the last game of the season. While Zion has gone back to the locker room after coming down a little awkwardly, he's going back to the locker room dealing with wrist injury complaints. So something to keep your eye on if you are a New Orleans fan, something you are absolutely holding your breath if you're a New Orleans fan, because the last thing you need is Zion with a sprained wrist or, you know, I'm not even going to speak worse, but something else were to occur, and now he's dinged up for the start of the playoffs after playing his probably healthiest season as a pro. So that is the last thing you want as a Pelicans fan, so we're all a little nervous right now. But back into the show, back to the topics of the show itself, I'm a LeBron guy. I am, right? I'm a LeBron guy, and I love the Pelicans. I do. They're my favorite team. LeBron's my favorite player. You have to understand, I'm basically... That's a great pass by De'Aaron Fox. He got stolen, but it wasn't because of the play. And then he made up for it on defense. God dog, I love De'Aaron Fox. But it wasn't due to LeBron's fandom, rather. You have to understand, I'm almost 27. I turned 27 in about a month. LeBron's been in the league 21 years. I was born in 1997. LeBron entered the league in 2003. My first cognitive memories of watching basketball was LeBron James. Like, so it's a situation where, like, guys who are 15 years older than me, their first cognitive memories of watching basketball is Michael Jordan. Think about it. If you're born in 1982, Jordan is the league in what, 86? 84. Jordan in the league in 84. So your first cognizant memories of Michael Jordan, or basketball, is probably of Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, or Larry Bird. Like, those are your three options. My first, especially because, you know, there's no league pass. You pretty much had to watch the game, the national TV game. If you're in Louisiana, New Orleans wasn't, you know, the New Orleans Hornets was no longer a thing. The Jazz had left, and, you know, the New Orleans Hornet was no longer a thing. So, and the Charlotte Hornets had moved. So, it was a situation where you had to wait till the national TV game. Well, national TV games in the 80s was Magic, Michael, Larry, or Detroit. Like, that was the national TV games. So a lot of people's first cognitive memories of basketball, and remember long playing basketball, was of Michael Jordan and the Bulls. So LeBron's my guy, right? And because LeBron's my guy, I tend to follow him wherever he goes. In terms of, I now invest in that team. I have all the jerseys. Not all the jerseys, obviously, but I have a jersey from the team. I have a Lakers. I have a Cavs. I have a Cavs the first time. I have a Heat. Like, I have a jersey from every team. So, you know, when he goes, I then throw my support. I'm not the only one. There's millions of us that do it, as evident by the ticket sales and the merchandise sales whenever he does change locations and the ratings for the teams. Okay, so LeBron, I get invested in the team. And I learn, you know, the style and the coaches. I'm kind of getting caught in the culture a little bit. It's almost like college recruitment in a way. But instead of like, it's not like when you're in college and you go to college in a different city and you like learn that city. Like for me, I'm from Baton Rouge, but I went to college in Hammond. Hammond's all about an hour and 15 minutes, hour from Baton Rouge, but it's something where you learn Hammond is a little different than Baton Rouge, you know what I'm saying? And you're learning it and you're learning how it operates and you're learning the restaurants and et cetera. You get ingratiated in the culture, you get ingratiated in Hammond, America, and it becomes a thing. Well, when LeBron changed his teams, he had about a 4-year pattern of changing. So it's almost like going to college. You'd learn the culture, you'd learn the city, you'd learn how this city operates, what are the true expectations, are they just LeBron-based expectations, or are they, you know, they're used to winning, so LeBron's the next guy to win. So, and I kind of say that because when he's in Cleveland, they never won. So a lot of expectations of what they were supposed to do were LeBron-based. He's so good that they're supposed to get here. Okay. He was good enough to back it up. They went to the Eastern Conference Finals a couple times. They made it to the NBA Finals. Like, and the team was mostly not great. But he was able to carry those guys with help into premium long-running playoff runs. Right? He gets to Miami. They were not necessarily used to winning. They had had a title. They had won a title in 06 with Dwayne Wade, but they were not necessarily used to winning. That was the only franchise, only title. They had been missed the playoffs in the doldrums since, right? But you got LeBron James, Chris Bosh, Dwayne Wade, all in their primes. They became, we're going to win because these guys are so good expectations. And they delivered. 2 titles, 4 title trips, they delivered, right? When LeBron goes back to Cleveland, he picks up Kyrie Irving, who at the time was a very flashy non-winner, and Kevin Love, who was a stat machine non-winner in Minnesota, and then they kind of built ancillary pieces around. So again, expectations became, we're going to win, not because the team's all that good, because LeBron's good. Then you go to the Lakers, and you get a different environment. The team is good, yes, but they're used to winning, and LeBron's the next guy to win. Wilt and Jerry won, Kobe won, Magic won. You're just the next guy to win here. It's the Lakers, we win, right? And so, that being said, you got to get ingratiated in that, blah, 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 blah. I say all that long stuff to say, Darvin Ham sucks. And I say this not only as a fan of LeBron James, I say this as a fan of basketball. Darvin Ham is horrible. What he did to the Lakers against the Warriors should have been professional malfeasance. It should have been a crime. No, a crime. It was professional malfeasance. It should have been a crime. It could have been potentially committed as a hate crime against LeBron. I'm not even sure what it would have been. Ages? I don't know. Favoritism, nepotism, buddyism, I don't know. That was insane. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, the Lakers and the Warriors are exchanging blows. LeBron's playing really well. The Warriors are raining threes, but the game is within reach. The Warriors end up actually shooting the best three-point percentage in the history of basketball with at least 40 attempts. So a high range, a high volume, rather, three-point day. They had the greatest shooting performance of all time. They made 26 of threes. It was, like I said, it was the highest percentage ever shooting over 40 attempts. Like I said, as far as an official high-range shooting team, they're the best ever, right? So it was like a bit uphill battle, but they were in the war, right? They were in it, right there, blow for blow. And then at the end of the third quarter, Darvin Ham puts a lineup on the floor. That is D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie, Taurean Prince, I believe Rui Hachimura and Jackson Hayes. That is professional malfeasance, coaching malpractice, an absolute crime against the state of California, against the Los Angeles Lakers fan base, and against LeBron James. That's a disgrace in terms of if you tell me you're trying to win. Because honestly, you're disrespecting winning at that point. And predictably, the Warriors go on this 13-2 run and push the game out and it's over. And ran it like 2 or 3 minutes. The starting lineup managed to only play 10 minutes together. I'm not even sure how you can do that with it without injuries. They managed to only play 10 minutes together. The lineup in question that had never played 1 second together got 3 minutes. And the guys you started the game with somehow got 10. To be upset at Darvin Ham is a waste of emotion. I'm going to be honest with you. It's pointless at this point. To be frustrated with him is like you're not doing enough. To want him fired feels like overkill. Like, he's such a guy that, seriously, I feel like he's trying stuff at this point, and it's just not working. And he's committing a crime against Laker Nation and is going to seriously jeopardize the ability for the Los Angeles Lakers to win a title. I don't think they can win a title with him. As great as LeBron James is, I do not think they can win a title with him. And LeBron has won 2 with Eric Spoelstra, 1 with Frank Vogel, and 1 with Tyronn Lue as a replacement coach midway through a season. I do not think he can win a title with Darvin Ham. That is how bad Darvin Ham is. It is as if he's never coached professional basketball a day in his life. And I feel like it shows up every time they're in a big moment, every time they're in a crunch, every time they're going through a war, Darvin Ham finds a new way to not be competent at his job. And it is just tragic that LeBron has to go through this at this stage of his career. But it shouldn't be all that shocking, despite how much winning the Lakers franchise has done over its illustrious history. They've had strong periods of ineptitude. They pretty much won in spite of management with Wilt and Jerry. And then Jerry Buss takes over. And then that's a mess at the beginning, but they get Magic. And so when you get Magic and you got Kareem, you kind of win. And then when those guys are gone, it's ineptitude again. And then Shaq decides, thanks to Jerry West, he wants to head west to your team, and you still suck. And then you get gifted this kid from Philadelphia, this high schooler named Kobe Bryant, and you start winning again, right? But that was strong pace too, even in Kobe's time. Like, he wanted to get traded at one point. Like, this team has gone through periods of just flat-out bad management. And I think what you're seeing on the court now is a symbol and a residual effect of what was happening in management. Remember the time where like Jeannie Buss had to like force her brothers out? It's like Mitch Kupchak running around and like Phil Jackson was heavily involved. Like, it was just a mess of Lakers. It was like they stayed in the 1980s and tried to do 2010s basketball. It was awful. Right? And after Kobe retired, it was awful. And then just like Jerry Buss convinced Shaq to go west from Orlando, Magic Johnson convinced LeBron to go west from Cleveland. And all of a sudden, there's this guy again. And then they get another guy named Anthony Davis. And then they win. And it's like you just kind of ignore all the bad. But what you're saying right now is all the bad with Darvin Ham. They should have just done what LeBron wanted them to do, what everybody thought they should have done, which was give Ty Lue this big. Ty Lue wanted 5 years. They offered him 3. The money wasn't the issue. Like, if they offer him 5 years, Ty Lue is the coach of the Lakers today. They probably win more than one title. Then you had Frank Vogel, and you let Frank Vogel go. Not saying Frank Vogel is the world's best coach. I have my issues with Frank Vogel. He's better than Darvin Ham. Like, he's dealt with a lot more injuries and nonsense than Phoenix, and they're playing really good basketball right now. So, I mean, it's just a sign of the ineptitude of the Lakers as an organization at times. You know, I mean, Pelinka was a nepotism hire connected to Kobe. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it is what it is. LeBron chose this. He's still choosing this. He's going to continue to choose this because the city of Los Angeles is far more important than the actual basketball itself right now. So before we dive too far into the playoffs, I want to propose you guys a question. And Chris Haynes proposed it on TNT to the crew, and they asked to hear their answers. Oh, look, I'm glad I didn't hear the answer. I don't want my opinion to be swayed. But we were speaking about those standings. Okay. The purpose of the play-in tournament was to give, number one, to make a little more money. Let's start off there. Number two, it was designed to give teams in the 9 and the 10, especially in those old eras of the West, where like the 10th seed would win like 46 games, 47 games, and then be the 10th seed, and then the 8th seed in the East would win like 40 games. You know what I'm saying? People put out the West being too hard. Now, my thing with that has always been even the games out, get rid of conferences, top 16 records go. If you really care about one side being stronger than the other. But they put the play-in tournament in. Well, okay, it originally got installed for the bubble. Let's back up. Originally got installed for the bubble. And it was designed because the teams would not have a full season. They would not have 482 games. They would only play 70 games. So, to make those last 12 games sort of kind of make sense and matter, they put the play-in tournament in. Teams 7 through 10, who will be vying for those last couple playoff spots, will then proceed to play, so they're in a mini tournament. The people who win that tournament win the playoff seats. You guys know how to play in tournament work. Okay, cool. So, it was such a success in the bubble, they continued it outside the bubble. This is the first year where this question is relevant. It's something that I thought about, others voiced when the play-in tournament came to be. What happens when the gap is so big that you're punishing the 7th and 8th seed for still playing? Hear me out. If the Bulls and the Hawks knew 2-3 weeks ago they were in the play-in tournament and no one was going to catch them. So it didn't matter how bad they looked. It didn't matter what they did. They were going to be 9-10 in the play-in tournament. And they were in no matter what. The play-in tournament was also designed, The play-in tournament was also designed to encourage 20 teams now to continue to play. Because you're playing for something. It also was to encourage the next 2 or 3 teams behind the 10 seed to play a little bit longer to see if they can get that 10 seed. So in the perfect world, you would entice 24 or 30 teams to play hard until early April. That's something that you could not do with 8 seeds, because if you're the 11th, if you're 6 games back with 15 to go or 14 to go, you start making choices. Like, okay, well, we're not going to catch them, right? However, 6 back from 8th may be 2 back from 10th, which will get you in the play-in tournament. So now you're playing a little bit harder. You know what I'm saying? And so, anyway, back to the point. I say all that to say, Chris Haynes on TNT posed to the crew, should the Heat and the Sixers be exempt from the play-in tournament due to the gap between 9 and 8? The Heat are 6.5 games up on the Bulls, and they are 8 games up on Atlanta entering Thursday's game. And yet, there is a chance for a couple of bad days of basketball that the Heat could be at home. And it's like, happy to report, Pelicans Nation, Zion's back on the court. For those who didn't watch the game and listen to the podcast, Zion is back on the court. But, you know, it's a little different in the West, where the 8th seed is a game up on the 10th seed. Okay, that's a perfect playing situation. Yeah, they had 82 games. Maybe one game difference. You know, perfect playing situation. It is not perfect. In the East, like I said, where the 7th and 8th are going to battle, I think Embiid gets it. Right, he gets the 7th seed if he doesn't find his way into the 6th seed. But regardless, the Heat are going to play two teams they were 8 games better than, or, you know, 4 to 7 games better than in the regular season, and could lose their playoff spot with a couple of bad, you know, a couple of threes that just don't fall, like a bad shooting night, could lose their playoff spot to a team they were 8 games clear of. You know, and so Chris Hayes proposed it. Should there be a certain number of games difference where you just say don't do the play-in tournament for the East? The West would do it, but I think if you're 6 games up, that team gets removed. So obviously the play-in tournament is 7 through 10. So I think if you're 6 games up from, if you're 6 games away from a 7th seed, that the whatever teams that are lower than that get removed. So this year, that would, six games, that would remove the Bulls and the Hawks from the play-in tournament. Or you could do 6 games from 8th, which in that case would remove the Hawks, but keep the Bulls. Bulls and Heat would go at it, win and get the 8th seed. 6 is automatic and 7th seed. Because I think that, it's kind of outrageous that, like, Atlanta is 8 games back of Miami and can end up the 8th seed. Like, we knew the play-in tournament may cause the standings to look a little wonky. Like, such and such made the playoffs, and they were 3 games worse than this team who didn't. Like, we knew that would be a problem. But to have an 8-game difference for the sake of continuing the play-in tournament, where you can simply, like I said, put a rule in where it's 6 games. You got a game rule for everything else, 65-game rule for individual awards and et cetera. Why not do a game rule for the play-in tournament? So you have to be within 6 games of the 8th seed in order to be in the play-in tournament. That sort of thing. I think that would cut down on, like, not purposeful tanking, but, like, individual tanking. Like, you can kind of tell that, like, Atlanta, besides when Trae Young came back, really wasn't all going all that hard because they knew they wouldn't play in tournament regardless. Their whole season came down to 2 games. Chicago the same way. They put some really funky lineups on the court. They know at the end of the day, they're just trying to keep home court in that first round of the play-in. But regardless, they are in the play-in. And so that's definitely a different feeling and a different pressure amount. And I do believe that there should be a certain number. I keep saying 6. 6 feels appropriate. I feel like there should be a certain number that if I'm up by that much or I'm down by that much, that the play-in tournament for corresponding seeds don't exist. All right, so let's dive into the playoffs. We do have one matchup confirmed. The only matchup truly that's confirmed, and that is the Clippers versus the Mavericks in the first round of the NBA playoffs. These are two teams that don't particularly like each other. They've had multiple wars over the years in the playoffs. Luka Doncic has had some great games against the Clippers, some great moments. There was the Marcus Morris stuff. There was all the pushing and the shoving. There was a lot of stuff going on in the Clippers and the Mavs. Not as entertaining as Mavs and Suns. That is going to be entertaining with Luka scoring more points at half than the Phoenix Suns roster did last year. But Luka and the Clippers have had some absolutely crazy wars. But a lot of it hinges on the fact that at a certain point, you can tilt the entire floor to Luka, double teaming and rotating all kind of stuff, and tilt the entire floor aimed at Luka. Well, that strategy doesn't work anymore because Kyrie Irving exists on the Mavs. So there's no such thing as, oh, we're going to half defend Kyrie, and he's going to take a bad shot or just stand there, because he's going to make a great decision with the ball, more than likely aim to score it. And so that's a strategy of basically isolate Luka and make the others beat you that doesn't necessarily work in this situation. So the Clippers are going to have to do something. They're doing a lot of injury management. I haven't heard much on Kawhi since he got the knee drain. Admittedly, I'm not the biggest Clipper insider. I haven't heard a lot about Kawhi, but even when they do their highlights, and Kawhi ain't on. So that'll be interesting to keep an eye on there. If you're the Mavericks, you have a chance to correct a lot of wrongs here. you have a chance to where you were the hunted. Now you could be the hunter. This is almost a dream path so far. If you are either one of these teams, because you have a chance to really go at it and kind of kick out some demons while you're at it from this series, whether it be individually guarding Luka or Luka getting over the hump and beating the Clippers. One thing I do want to talk about the play-in tournament with, and I should have mentioned in my last segment, is that is the play-in tournament a disadvantage for the 1 and the 2 seed? Because now you have to prep for 2 teams at the same time. You have to learn 2 scouting reports, do all this different stuff. Then it's playoff level scouting reports and in-depthness and et cetera. Like, it's not just something that you can throw together or that you can look at a basketball game and, oh, this person likes post split, so this person likes a slot cut, et cetera. There's percentages and all this other stuff. But I think that could be a major disadvantage to the play-in, to the top 2 seeds. Normally not a problem, but with somebody like Joel Embiid and the Sixers lurking around that 7th seed, if you don't know you're playing Joel Embiid until, you know, 4 days before, that could be a huge problem with your game planning and things of that nature. But that is all I have for the NBA, and now we're going to shift into college basketball. Welcome back into the show. And now we're going to talk about the conclusion of the college basketball season. I kind of want to look forward into next season. So congratulations in order. Shout out to the South Carolina Gamecocks on winning the women's national championship, their 3rd national title in 7 years, I believe, under Dawn Staley. The dynasty is officially on in Columbia. All their legends have a ring at this point. Aja Wilson, who already has her statue, has a title. Leah Boston, so I had a brain cramp there. Again, watching this Pelicans Kings game, my apologies. But Leah Boston has her ring, and now Camila Cardoza has her ring. So post-U is kind of what they're being nicknamed around the college basketball world, because they just keep developing these amazing post players, which is crazy because Dawn's a guard and none of her guards are that dominant. I mean, Gaia Cook's okay, but you know what I'm saying, none of her guard, Bria Bill's solid, but none of her guards are making high level impact at the professional level, at least in the WNBA. Yeah, her posts are becoming like megastars, so that's pretty interesting there. But also congratulations to the University of Connecticut men's basketball team for securing their 2nd title in a row, going back-to-back, dominating the NCAA tournament for the 2nd consecutive year. They've won 12 consecutive tournament games, obviously, winning 2 titles. They've won every single game by an average of about 23 points. They won last year's title and winning by 20 points a game. And they won this year's title, winning about 23, I believe. So about 21, 22 points a game, they're winning NCAA tournament games. They're not just winning, they're crushing people. And it's not even a situation where it's like, oh, they're blowing out the first round team by like 60. So then at that point, you know, they're just kind of slowly doing. Like, they're winning Final Four games by 25. Like, they are absolutely dominating opponents right now. Hurley has built a juggernaut in Connecticut. Very interested to see what he does with the Kentucky job open, which we'll get to in a second. But he's built an absolute juggernaut in Connecticut. He knows what he wants. He's competing with Gino Auriemma. He's not gonna have the career Gino Auriemma had at UConn, obviously. That's just a bad bet to make. Like, oh, Bobby Hurley is going to have a similar coaching career to Gino Auriemma. Like, that's a bad bet. Gino Auriemma has top three most wins, men and women ever. He's like 100 national titles. Like, that's a bad bet. He has a win streak of over 100 at a certain point. Like, horrible bet, right? But he is, you know, he's already got two national titles. He's going back to back. And he's talking about UConn basketball. He says that he doesn't mean men's basketball. He means UConn basketball. The University of Connecticut collegiate basketball. Men and women have been are the standard right now. Yes, South Carolina has the titles. Yes, South Carolina has Dawn Staley. But without half the roster, Paige Beckers and UConn was in the Final Four and was, I think, a bad call moving screen away from potentially either going to overtime or facing South Carolina in the national championship game. So UConn basketball as a whole is running college basketball right now. Definitely the best basketball program in the country. North Carolina State had a pretty good run as well. Both of their teams went to the Final Four. But I think that this is a major opportunity for UConn to really solidify their claim at the top of college basketball. But congratulations to the University of Connecticut and South Carolina on winning the men's and women's national championships, respectively. Now, we spoke about it just a second ago, or we began to, and then I backed off for 5 years reasons, but Dawn Staley winning her third national championship. Lots of history involved, a lot of stuff no other African-American coach has done, a lot of stuff that no coach has done. You know, we know some of her stuff, like she's the only person to ever win Naismith Player of the Year and Naismith Coach of the Year, a Wooden Award for player and coach. Like, we know some of this stuff and what she's done. We know about her gold medals. We know about her national championships. We know about her time as a player in the WNBA, right? And it's just, you almost begin to question if she's the GOAT. And is there a case? Yes. Now, it's a small case. Now, women's college basketball in general, there's such a gap in terms of wins. Like, Gina Auriemma's over 1,000. Tara Vanderveer, who just retired at Stanford, Stanford calling her the GOAT, she's over 1,000. C. Vivian Stringer was a really high number. Pat Summitt is over 1,000. Like, you get some of these wins and you're like, my God, like, especially like I said, in college basketball, these people hold jobs, this same job, 25, 30 years, and they're a dominant program. If they're 30 years, they're a dominant program, 25 of them. So they're winning 30 games every year, or 25 games every year for 20 years. Like, their numbers are just insane, right? So congratulations to Dawn. Like I said, she has a GOAT case in the sense of, like, Jim Brown has a running back GOAT case, or Barry Sanders has a running back GOAT case. Like, yeah, okay, you don't have the physical counting numbers of some of the people, but the impact of the social ramifications of a Dawn Staley and what she's doing right now for black coaches, for black players at a non-HBCU. Like, she's not at HBCU. She's South Carolina. She's not at South Carolina State. She's not at, you know, somewhere like that. She's at the University of South Carolina in the SEC. And what she's doing there is absolutely spectacular. She's well on her way to having a counting numbers GOAT argument. But, you know, I've seen Gina Auriemma win a lot. I don't think women's basketball has ever been more competitive. I just don't. I don't think women's basketball is ever more competitive than it is right now. I grew up watching women's basketball. I'm not one of these people that popped in the last 2 years because of Caitlin Clark Show, who we'll talk about. I grew up watching the Candace Parkers. I used to jokingly call Candace Parker my big sister. I tried to steal all of her moves, like the little up and under step through that is effectively a travel, but not really. I tried to steal everything. I even learned how to shoot, like, off my face. Like, you know, I tried to do everything just like Candace Parker. So I grew up watching Candace Parker. I grew up watching Maya Moore. I grew up watching Simone Augustin, Sylvia Fowles. I grew up watching Tamika Johnson on the point guard for LSU. I grew up watching all these great players. Breanna Stewart at Kentucky winning 4 straight national championships. And in my later years, you get to Brennan and that Scrooge of the world. You get, I had the 3-C. I was like in high school, I think when the 3-C came to WNBA, which we'll talk about that later as well. When Brittany Griner, Skylar Diggins, and LA and Dylan all came out of school together. Like, I'm old enough to have seen all this, right? So I have a scope and a grasp on the women's game. To me, the golden era of the women's game in terms of, yes, the pre-WNBA era was different. You had Sherrod Miller. You had Kim Mulkey. Like, Kim Mulkey, probably a top 3 pick in the WNBA draft. She won a national championship with Louisiana Tech. Right, like she's probably a top pick in the WNBA draft. Sherrod Miller's easily the number one pick. You're probably the GOAT if the WNBA existed then. I'm not old enough to have seen Sherrod Swoops, right? But she was Air Swoops. Like she had her own shoe deal like Air Jordan. Like she was it. But I understand the history of the game. Sherrod Miller was so good, multiple men's leagues wanted her to play in their leagues. Like, I'm old enough to, I know the game enough to know this. I know enough to say Dawn's well on her way. Well on her way. She's been there in 7 years. She's got 3 titles. She's already produced, in my opinion, multiple college basketball Hall of Famers. Asia Wilson and Leah Balton are both going to go in the Hall of Fame. Camila Godoza potentially has a case. She's already winning gold medals. She's on her way and on a pace and on a path that if she sticks to Columbia, she's going to win 7 or 8 national titles over the course of 20 years, 25 years. And she stays in South Carolina, she's going to probably make over $100 million coaching. And then on top of that, she'll have 7 national titles in 20 years and is a Hall of Famer before she retires. I mean, that's the level, which I'm going to be honest, let you on a secret, Dawn Staley should be a Hall of Famer as is. She should be a Pro Basketball Hall of Famer. If for nothing more, if you don't want to put her in as a coach yet, put her in as a contributor to the game. For what she did for college basketball, for Virginia, you know, what she did for the Olympics teams, what she did for the WNBA, now what she's doing coaching, she should be in the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. Definitely in the Women's Basketball Hall of Fame, for sure. But she should be in Springfield in the Pro Basketball Hall of Fame. Point blank period. She's well on her way to being a GOAT. She's not the GOAT, truly. And I said she was, but she's truly not. But she is beyond well on her way to being there. She's the modern GOAT. To me, Pat Summitt, Gina Auriemma, Tara Vanderveer, even truly Kim Mulkey, those people are yesteryear. Still great accomplishments. Still love and appreciate all of them. But to me, they're yesteryear in terms of their GOAT argument. Dawn Staley's leading the new school. She has no peers. She's so dominant that she's being compared to the legends of yesteryear because there's only people that can talk and compare to her, right? So that is what Dawn Staley's got going on in South Carolina. Very commendable to her. And lastly, and finishing up on this topic or the women's side of it anyway, I want to talk about Caitlin Clark. Now, you guys, if you listen to the show, you listen to the audio show on a regular basis, or you watch the YouTube show, Justin Time Sport Podcast on YouTube, of course, we'll put the link in the description as well, just like we did last week, but the link to the show is in last week's description. Expect that next episode coming out sometime early next week. But you guys have heard me talk about Caitlin Clark. Okay. Again, I'm not going to run through my basketball history. You guys heard it. One of my women basketball history. I don't feel like I'm an expert in this topic, but I feel like I'm knowledgeable enough to know enough. You know? Like, I know what I know, and I know what I don't know. Caitlin Clark, people want to put her in the GOAT conversation. Some of the people I named in that long list of things have multiple college titles, multiple Wooden Awards. Like, yes, they don't have the raw scoring of a Caitlin Clark. Yes, they don't have the 30-foot bomb highlights. Yes, they don't have, like, an entire, like, nation feeding out of their hands. But they won a lot. And they won individually. They won as a team. Individually, they won, all won, a lot of good majority of them won Wooden Awards. All of them were that name. I think Tamika Johnson doesn't have one. I believe Simone got one while she was at LSU. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure Simone got one when she was at LSU. Maybe the LSU teams didn't really get them. But a vast majority of the team people I named have Wooden Awards and national titles. Again, the LSU girls do not have national titles. But a majority of LSU women, I'm sorry, do not have national titles. But a majority of them I named have national titles, have Wooden Awards, have these accomplishments in their careers. Caitlin Clark has the Wooden Awards. I give you that. No national championships. She lost 2 years in a row to SEC schools, one to Angel Reese and LSU, year two to Camilla Cardoza and the South Carolina Gamecocks. Great player, all-time scorer, one of the legends in the game, one of the legends in women's college basketball. She deserves her jersey retired, which it is. She deserves a statue outside of the arena, which I'm sure there will be. I'm sure they may permanently mark where she made the record-breaking shot. It was marked at one point, but it got rubbed off. People want to take pictures at the spot. I legitimately believe she deserves all that. If you want to go and like rename part of the arena for her, do it. Right? She's that good. She means that much to Iowa basketball. She means that much to the state of Iowa. She has meant that much to the women's college basketball game, so she helped grow it. But she wasn't the only one. You know, you had a lot of people contribute to the game. The class 2020, to me, is responsible for the elevation of the women's game to where it is now. That class includes Paige Beckers as the clear-cut best player in the class, Cameron Brink, Angel Reese, Camilla Cardoza, and Caitlin Clark. What further five could you possibly want in one high school class in relation to this group is going to elevate the game? No one else may not do it. This group's going to do it, right? Like, there's no other class you could possibly imagine between those five, at the time, young ladies, but, you know, those five women. Four of them are going next level. Paige coming back. But speaking back on Caitlin Clark, you have all these records. You have all this stuff. And at the end of the day, you're ringless. So how can I put you in a position where you challenge Breanna Stewart, who has two Wooden Awards and four titles? Maya Moore, who I believe has had two Wooden Awards and three titles. Put you up there with Candace Parker, who has a Wooden Award and a title. Put you up there with Cheryl Miller. Put you up there with Cheryl Swoops. Put you up there with all these legends. You got Wooden Awards. I give you that. No titles. And when you want to enter into a situation where you want to be a GOAT, you don't have to have as many titles as Breanna Stewart. She's got four, right? If it was about titles and Wooden Awards, Breanna Stewart in the argument. She has two Wooden Awards and four titles. That means in order to beat her, you have to have at least three Wooden Awards and four championships. Like, she would be the undisputed GOAT for life. So you don't have to have as many titles as Breanna Stewart, but you got to come with at least a Wooden Award and probably two titles to get into the argument. You know what I'm saying? Like, you're going to have to come with two of something and one of the other in order to get in the conversation. She's got the Wooden Awards. She didn't have the ring. Amazing career. Very commendable career. A career that put Iowa basketball on the map. Put Iowa athletics on the map, because the football team's a disaster. Put Iowa athletics on the map and highlighted the women's game and helped grow it to the casual fan. So kudos to her for that. She had a pressure on her every single game that not many people could even fathom. She kind of spoke about it. That pressure of even like her fellow senior teammates when they were playing the round of 64-32 in Iowa, the pressure that they felt to not lose in Iowa. It was like, you know, they didn't want to lose on the court, you know. So she's gonna have to be carried a franchise in WNBA, and we'll speak about that a little bit more in Jack's Hot Take, rather. But kudos to her for kind of getting an induction into it with Iowa. A few quick hitters. John Calipari has left the officially left the Kentucky Wildcats program to stay in the SEC, but moves to the Arkansas Razorbacks after 15 years at Kentucky. In his introduction, which was kind of funny, it was weird seeing him in red. He's been in blue for over 20 years. He was at Memphis with Derrick Rose. That was blue. And then he goes to Kentucky. He switches out tight Memphis blue for Kentucky blue. And now he's in red. I mean, it was like bright red with a little Razorback on it. So, I mean, it was really weird to see him in red, right? And he spoke about his press conference, a couple of things just real quick. Number one, he spoke about having a meeting with the roster. He laughed and said, there is no roster. He's not kidding. They have one player. Everybody else either graduated or transferred out. They literally have one player. So that's why he made the joke about meeting with the roster. There is no roster because he has one player. And also he spoke about how it was his time at Kentucky. They needed a new voice in the building. They just needed a new situation. It was time. It was 15, it's been there 15 years. He won over 400 games at Kentucky, winning a national title with Anthony Davis and my kid Gilchrist. And he said it was just time to move on from Kentucky. And I think the model, Kentucky had invested so much in the model that even if he wanted to deviate from the model, people at Kentucky weren't used to the losing. Because when you transition from building your program in the land of the one and done to now all of a sudden pivoting and wanting to build less one-and-done guys and more guys that might stay, like a UConn, 2, 3, 4, even grad transfer in. That takes about a year or two of transition. So instead of going 25-7, like you always do, or 26-6, you might go 20-12. And go a couple rounds of SEC tournament, you might get in the tournament, the big dance, you might be an SEC team. But it's going to take you more than likely a recruiting class or two in order to get the different style of player in. And I believe that, hold on. I have to correct myself. So earlier in the NBA segment, I said that this game was for the tiebreaker. It is not. The Pelicans are 4-0 against the Kings this season. My apologies to the New Orleans Pelicans. I should know that as a Pelicans fan. But they are undefeated against the Kings this season, so this game is not for the play-in not for the tiebreaker at all. My apologies to the New Orleans Pelicans. But back to what I was saying, it's just weird for him being in red. He's got a lot of work to do. I mean, the Calipari thing involves the heir to the Tyson chicken. Tyson food, you know, that makes the Tyson chicken bites. Yeah, the heir to the fortune is friends with Calipari, who helped lure him to Fayetteville, and in turn also helped give Calipari the biggest NIL resource budget in college basketball, with over, they said, $5 million annually to NIL could be allocated. For reference point, Kansas was the most expensive NIL team this season. They were just over $4 million. So that's an extra $1 million that Calipari has disposal again annually in Fayetteville in order to get guys to come to Arkansas. He may steal a couple Kentucky's recruits. They're all requesting out of their letters of intent. The school for the most part has been cooperative from what I've seen and letting them out. Schools are not in the position of holding kids. That just creates bad reputations and all kind of stuff. So the school has been real generous in letting those guys out of their letters of intent. And if you're the Kentucky, you have to get a coach in fast because you have to completely rebuild your recruiting class from Jump Street, whether that's bringing your own guys in, whether that is deciding that, you know, you're going to try and keep the Kentucky guys, whatever it is. You're going to have to rebuild your rotation from literal Jump Street. So that is going to be intriguing for whoever becomes a new head person in Lexington. Um, that is all I have for the college basketball segment. Because anything else I want to delve into, I'm going to get into is Jack's hot take, which is going to be about the WNBA. And this is the most important draft in the history of the WNBA. Welcome back into the show, and now we're going to talk about Jack's hot take, which is going to be my take on the upcoming WNBA draft being the single most important WNBA draft in the history of the league. The league that was conceptualized and birthed in 1996, this is the most important draft since its inception. Yes, the first draft had legends. Tina Thompson is the first player to ever sign a contract with the WNBA. I believe Cheryl Swoops is the first player to ever be drafted into the WNBA. Then there's been stars that have matriculated their way in. See Candace Parker, see Maya Moore. To me, the most important draft class prior to this was the 3-C. They were about a decade ago. It was Brittany Griner, Skylar Diggins, and Elena Delladon. It was fresh off of Brittany Griner winning a title at Baylor. She comes out. Delladon is the small school superstar. If the transfer portal existed, she's probably at a UConn, an LSU, somewhere. Like, she's not at Delaware out 4 years. It's on the table because I believe she's from Delaware area. And she's really close to her family. I believe it's her sister. I'm not going to go too far into it, but she has reason to be near her family. So maybe ultimately she doesn't. But with NIL money, she may have gotten $1.5 million, $2 million a year to go to a big school that would have gotten her family what they needed, basically. So ultimately, and then of course, Skylar Diggins from Notre Dame, who made the Ninja Headband. I don't care what anybody says. That should be, if Skylar Diggins had NIL money, she's one of, if not the richest people to ever have NIL, because Nike would have given her the Ninja Headband in a way. Like, not giving it to her, but giving it to her. Like, she would have been marketing for it. Maybe she trademarks it. She's the only person I've seen wear that headband. Like, she was the only person in college, girls college basketball, wearing that headband. People wearing head wraps. People may have worn different things trying to hold their hair back, but as far as major female college basketball in terms of wearing something to protect their hair, the head wrap from Skylar Diggins, the Ninja Headband, it became known in the NBA, was her thing. She's the only person really wearing it. She would have made a multitude of millions of dollars off of it had she been able to, you know, market it and trademark it, etc. But that was the most important class. Right, it was easily the most important class. Those three came in. They were labeled 3-C. It was the first WNBA class I remember being incredibly marketed. They were marketed everywhere. They were blasted on everything. They were everywhere because everybody anticipated their arrival. Okay, like I said, that was about a decade ago. I don't remember the exact year, but that was a while ago. The 3-C. This class is about 10 times more important than that. In the end, that class didn't do much to go to the WNBA. Brittany Griner is mostly known for the Russian incident. Skylar Diggins is mostly known for her looks. And Elena Delladon is mostly known for being good at basketball. But, like, for the most part, they didn't really move the needle. The WNBA was still poorly marketed. At the time, they were flushing out the old owners. Not a lot of the newer owners are in, but they were flushing out a lot of the old owners. It didn't grow. The opportunity was there, and they didn't take it. Bad commissioner, whatever. This class, however, thanks to the growth of college basketball, and it started in the bubble, which the WNBA bubble, female basketball grew in the world. The ratings shot up for the W during the bubble during COVID. It was the only thing on TV. Right, so people watched, people actually enjoyed the game, people were social media about it positively, etc. The game grew. The WNBA has seen steady ratings growth. Women's college basketball followed behind it. Steady growth. Right? It is matriculated up. then this class, this class 2020, this is the COVID class, absolutely explodes on the scene. You have Paige Becker, who's one of the most highly rated recruits and highly touted recruits ever in women's college basketball. You have Cameron Brink, a 4.5, 5-star recruit. You have Caitlin Clark, who probably is UConn's point guard if it's not for Paige Becker. You have Angel Reese, who's a 4.5-star going to Maryland. Then you have Camilla Cardoza, the 6'7" monstrous from IM. Well, this is IMG, but the 6'7" monstrous heading to South Carolina, right? So this is the COVID class. They're the class 2020. So now they're entering WNBA, and then four of them are entering. Paige decided to go back to UConn, unfinished business, along with, I think she wanted a chance to play with her team. When they were mostly healthy, she was out. When she was healthy, they were out. So I think she wants an opportunity to play with her team. Plus, she's doing a lot of great things in the community, utilizing her NIL money and her connections and her face, etc. And plus, financially, there's no rush to the WNBA at all, right? And so Paige has decided to come back to school. However, the other four are entering the draft. The WNBA has already started, and they're doing good. I like Kathy Engelbert, I believe is her name, the WNBA commissioner. She's doing great already. What she's doing, she's made a commercial called Rookie O's, where Breanna Stewart's eating Rookie O's cereal, introducing the rookies. They're blasting all the star profiles, Angel Reese, Caitlin Clark, Camilla Cardoza, Cameron Brink. They're blasting them all over TV. They're being blasted all over social media. They are plastering the world as much as they can with WNBA draft, introducing these rookies. They're also responding in kind with what they're giving in terms of what they're giving with Caitlin Clark. I am not the world's biggest Caitlin Clark fan, though admittedly, she's entertaining. But she's a lightning rod for popularity in America, especially in white America. So what people are doing is that they are marketing towards Caitlin Clark. For instance, the Phoenix Mercury have already produced an ad that says Goat versus Rook. And it is a female silhouette that honestly looks like Caitlin Clark's silhouette on the poster with Diana Taurasi with goat across her chest. And they're marketing the Indiana Fever game. It's a safe marketing strategy because regardless if Indiana does something highly unforeseen and picks somebody other than Caitlin Clark, it's still the GOAT versus the number one pick in their mind, so it's not a bad marketing strategy, right? The Las Vegas Aces have moved their game from the Fever, from what I call the side arena, it's a much smaller arena. But they have moved them from a smaller arena into the bigger, into the playoff arena, the T-Mobile Arena, for the game against the Indiana Fever, as well anticipating a large crowd, right? And so the WNBA is taking unprecedented measures to support the Caitlin Clark bonanza. But they're also not ignoring the fact that they have an Angel Reese. They're not ignoring the fact that they have a Camilla Cardoza. They're not ignoring the fact that they have Brain Cram, all that kind of, but they're not ignoring the fact that Cameron Brink, and they're not ignoring the fact that they have all these other stars, and they are doing a great job because they know, like I know, this is the most important class I've ever had. If this class busts out, there's a chance that the WNBA may never recover, in terms of it will never elevate to the level that it should. However, this class is the hits they've been their whole lives. The WNBA could be carried to a level not equal to the NBA, but what people are looking forward to the WNBA during the summer. So that is what this class has on their shoulder. They have the future and the vitality of the WNBA on their shoulders. They carried it for women's college basketball. They made it through. Angel and Caitlin wore heavy crowns specifically. But this class has the ability to alter the way the WNBA is seen around the world. But that is all I have for you today. I hope you guys have a great rest of your Friday. I'm excited that you're listening to this and your weekend is right next door. I'm excited that you are listening to this and, you know, you're potentially already enjoying your weekend. However, whatever the case may be, I hope that you have a great rest of your weekend. Look for the video show sometime mid next week. We should be recording it sometime next Tuesday. You should get that sometime next Thursday or Friday. But of course, I'll remind you as right before we record, because I'll probably do the audio show first. But again, that's all I have for you today. This is your host, Justin Jackson, signing out. We'll be right back.